The following is inspired by actual events and is meant for a mature audience. Your hosts are lifelong horror fans.
What you are about to see.
It's called the Monster Club.
Welcome to the Monster Club, an honest look at horror movies from lifelong horror fans. Fair warning, you may not have seen this movie. We have! Spoilers ho! I am Jethel.
I'm Doc. And this week, we're going to take a look back at the 1980 horror, The Changeling, starring George C. Scott, Trish Van Devere, and Melvin Douglas.
As far as I'm concerned, one of the best horror movies to come out of the 80s.
You strongly urged me to get this DVD.
I love a good ghost story.
Me too. They're my favorite scary movie. Horror doesn't always have to mean blood and guts and
jump scares.
Yeah, I'm really surprised that this movie got an R rating. It has an R rating. And the only reason I can think of for it to have an R rating is that a child gets drowned in a bathtub. And that's it.
The only reason I can think of it.
It, by today's standards, this would get PG. So this is definitely...
Maybe PG-13.
I don't know. I think a child would have to be, like, killed by dismemberment, you know, or stabbed to death. There would have to be some sort of bloody violence.
Now, where do they draw the line PG, PG-13 when it comes to child murder?
I don't know, when
there's no blood involved. I mean, I know if there's actual blood involved, then it gets the 13 or R rating.
Yeah, but there was, you know, and it's not like, you know, his father was holding him down, choking him to death or anything. He was just holding his feet, letting the boy drown. So, I don't know. But yeah, I was very surprised. I kept waiting for the big, you know, the big R-rated stuff to happen. It just never did. But it didn't detract from the scariness of this film.
No, this movie has everything that I'm looking for in a ghost story. This one is one that doesn't shock you right away, but makes you think later.
It builds up a uneasy tension throughout the whole film, and this film really exemplifies the line of thought where jump scares are kind of a cheap trick. You know, exactly. There are no jump scares in this movie. None whatsoever, not in the sense that, you know, something shocking or something innocuous happens and there's a big musical cue and everyone goes, you know.
Nope, nothing like that at all.
Nothing. It just builds and builds and builds and builds.
Also, very little in the way of special effects.
Yeah, nearly nothing. The only special effect I could spot was down in the well with the metal, and that was it. That was just film running backwards.
Right. They just dragged the metal underground, you know, letting the chain follow, and then they just reversed the film.
Yeah, that was very effective.
And during the seance, the glass flying off the table.
Yeah,
of course, that could have been done with fishing line.
Yeah,
but it was all practical.
Yeah, this is 1980.
Right, there was no CGI back then.
There weren't even any film effects. You know, there was no blue screen. There was no ghostly apparitions, in the way of like glowing anything. You know, it was all just what you see is what was in front of the camera, and that's it.
This is a fantastic movie, and if more movies were like this, I would respect Hollywood a lot more, I tell you that.
It is a lost art, I think.
It is. It's a fantastic story. Let's go over the story a little bit here.
Yeah.
Okay, so John Russell loses his wife and young daughter in a tragic car accident.
Yeah, that was, I love the way the movie starts off with that, you know, and it makes you immediately get interested into the character, you know, of this composer. You immediately empathize with this tragic, horrific accident. And I love the way that, you know, they didn't, you know, there's hardly any blood in this movie. So when the accident happens, you don't see anything. It's just you see the cars collide and go where his wife and daughter are out of view, blocked by the vehicles. So you immediately understand that what's happened, and the look on his face as he's trying to get out of that phone booth, you know.
Oh, yeah. So wife and daughter are killed. He moves to Seattle. to rebuild his life.
Yeah, that, it was in upstate New York, so he went cross country to get away from things and try to put his life back together.
Mm-hmm. Gains a position in the University of Washington, musical advanced theory. He's a composer, mm-hmm. of course. He moves into a house owned by the Historical Society. Little does he know that tragedy happened years before.
Mm-hmm.
And the spirit of the child in the house wants his attention desperately.
Do you think he would have been as interested in the mystery of the house if he hadn't just recently lost his wife and daughter in such a way? I think that spurred him on. And I think that the spirit of the boy initially makes contact with this guy because of what he senses this man has been through. He's okay. Well,
they have a seance, and the medium even says the spirit is reaching out to you through your grief.
Mm-hmm.
So if nothing else, it made it easier for the spirit mm-hmm. to communicate with John Russell.
Mm-hmm. And it just starts out very mildly. You know, he notices little noises, the banging, stuff like that, you know, and none of it's, you know, any special effect, ghost drifting across the screen, transparent or anything like that. It's just stuff happening.
Yep.
Like, in any old house.
I told Liz while we were watching it last night, I would like to see this movie remade, but remade correctly. The problem is, I mean, because there were a few points in the movie that were just not done well.
Were just done to the style of filmmaking of the day.
Right,
you know,
right.
It definitely felt like a late 1970s movie. That's when it was filmed.
Right, but I'm talking about the EVP, the electronic voice recorder. So they have a seance, and the medium is asking questions, and she asks, you know, what is your name? And you just hear,
what is your name?
On the tape. And it's obviously not a little boy.
Yeah, it's kind of like a high-pitched...
It's a woman.
They should have just, you know, used the boy that they used for, you know, to play the part of the boy when he was alive, when he was killed, and just said, okay, here, you say these things. But I guess they couldn't get him to sound spooky enough, maybe?
I don't know. But, I think that's something that could have been done better.
Yeah.
Who would you like... If they were to redo this movie, who would you like to see as John Russell? What modern actor could portray this? I have somebody in mind. I want to see who you come up with.
Well, immediately Craig T. Nelson comes to mind, but he was, you know, his association with Poltergeist would be a little janky.
And he's more of a comedic actor.
Yeah.
My thought actually was Harrison Ford.
Would be good, yeah. Harrison Ford.
He's the right age, and I think he can bring the intensity. I mean, George C. Scott, if nothing else, is an intense actor.
Yeah, he is.
He's very great. Serious.
Yeah, he's got a great presence, great voice.
Mm-hmm.
He passed away in 99.
Yes, he did.
But yeah, I can certainly see that. Harrison Ford would be good.
As for the effects...
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the practical effects on this movie that were effective. There was a lot of effective things that were just very simply done. The ball bouncing down the stairs.
Yes. And
the ball that belonged to his deceased daughter.
Yeah, that teleported out of the desk. You don't see that happen. It just has happened, and you hear this thump, thump, thump. And from the perspective, you don't see the ball coming down the steps until it comes into frame. You know, because you're down on the camera is down on the floor looking into the study where he's sitting. And he gets up to walk over to hear what this sound is coming down the steps. And then you see the ball bounce into frame. You're like, oh, my God.
He takes the ball to a bridge. He's like, no.
Fuck this noise.
No, I'm sorry. I love my daughter, and this was her ball, but you're not going to use my daughter against me. And he chucks the ball.
Do you think he was just freaked out at that point? He was just like, oh, big cup of nope.
Probably, it could have been. I think one of the emotions that George T. Scott has a problem with is fear.
I love, you know, One of the, just real quick. One of the things, you know, I recently watched all 8 Harry Potter films. And after having read the books for the first time, I kept noticing things that they show in the movie that you only understand after having read the books, after some explanation. And I'm like, oh, that's why, you know? And they, in The Changeling, they make an extra special effort to make sure that you understand that the ball is significant. And I love that. They didn't just mention it offhand. They make a whole scene out of associating the ball with the daughter and then showing him putting the ball into the desk, that you're thinking about the ball. The ball is significant.
Right.
You know, and I love the quality of that. That sort of quality of in filmmaking.
And Joseph, the spirit of the little boy, knows that ball is important.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
This is how I'm going to get John Russell's attention.
So just by demonstrating without exposition or having somebody explain it to the stupid character sidekick or anything like that, any of those cheap tricks, they make it very clear that the spirit knows what's up. And that he is interested in communicating about a specific subject, you know,
right. His
death and losing a family member and whatnot.
So he chucks the ball into the river, goes back home, and come bouncing down the stairs once again is the wet ball.
Mm-hmm. Right as soon as he comes home.
Joseph says, no, I want your attention.
I think Scott pulled off scared pretty good right there. I mean, he did look pretty freaked out in that moment, looking down at the wet ball on the floor as it came to a rest near his feet.
Okay, that's the ball. Child's wheelchair. The chase scene.
Did that happen before or after? Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. We're just talking about special
effects. I'm just talking about practical effects.
Yeah, now, so...
Very simply done.
Yeah,
I mean, chair itself could have been pulled along by a fishing line or something like that. And, of course, during the chase scene,
Could have been just pushed by people right off camera. It was a very close shot, you know, with the chair just kind of trundling after her. They didn't do any wide shots.
No. And any shot you saw, any kind of wide shot was very quick. It comes out of a doorway and then cut, you know, that kind of thing. Again, simple but very effective.
I love the way that they use the cuts to sort of glaze over the fact that it would have to, you know, trundle down some stairs, all these different flights of stairs. It just kept appearing behind her pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
As she went down reached each landing and ran along the banister to get away from this thing. It was good.
Now, one of the scenes that stands out to me as good acting, George C. Scott doesn't hardly move at all, but it's one little action. He's listening to the tape for the first time, and it's just as the voice of Joseph starts telling his story, the cigarette slips from George C. Scott's fingers.
Really?
You didn't notice that?
I did not notice that.
Yep, he's listening to the tape. He looks around the room for a little bit, then he focuses on the tape recorder, and he just is just before he starts asking, "How did you die? How did you die?" He's just looking at the tape recorder like, "I can't believe I'm hearing this shit," and the cigarette falls from his fingers. You did not see that.
Yeah, I'm actually poking at the... Well, I'm trying to get it to load up.
All right,
There it goes.
Let me find a timestamp for you here.
Still got it.
Will you tell us why you are not at rest?
My son!
Joseph, did you die in this house?
My room.
How did you die?
Okay, I saw him drop it. I wonder what he...
How did you die?
Yeah, I didn't catch that the first time I watched this. I watched it again just this morning. I didn't catch it again. Huh.
Well, I have seen this movie dozens of times.
That's definitely a good moment. Very subtle. I love it when actors do things like that. I wonder if it's in the script or...
I don't know.
If that was improvised. Man, it's really makes me really wish that they had, they thought of things like commentaries for films back in
19. Yeah, they didn't think about it back then.
So special effects, what?
There's fire, yeah. Lots of fire at the end of this movie. And of course, that was all real.
Yeah, that was really, I guess they had to do it that way. Because I kept questioning, you know, why would they just build the whole facade to this house? And then all the interior sets, or all the interior spaces are sets.
Right. Or interlocking sets, yeah. And
I wonder if they were freestanding so that they could freely be set fire to, or what?
I would assume so. I mean, you don't want to set something on fire that's inside.
Yeah.
But yeah, at the time, it was the largest facade ever built, $200,000 to build the exterior of that house.
Mm-hmm. That has to have been a good chunk of the budget for this film. The budget wasn't very large by today's standards. I'm reading... Well, I don't know if this is correct. It says $600,000.
Well, I've got, well, 7,600,000 Canadian.
For the budget? Okay. Yes. I can see there's like a stray comma there that appears to have been misplaced. Of course, that's current currency conversion.
Yeah. Okay, so by U.S. standards, it cost at the time $5.6 million.
At the time, so you're using 1980 conversion?
Yeah, rates? Yeah. Well, that's just Canadian to U.S.
Okay.
No idea what that would convert to today. Probably quite a bit more.
And with the box office, it says 5.3 million on Wiki. That's disappointing.
I didn't even realize it came out in the theaters. I saw it on TV in the 80s.
Hmm. Yeah, I did see that the box says HBO Films. I guess they must have bought the publishing rights.
No problem.
For the, you know, to put it on DVD. Mm-hmm. But it definitely wasn't some, you know, little known throwaway film that no one noticed. Martin Scorsese.
Oh, yes. Is it his top scariest movies of all time?
Mm-hmm.
Set in Seattle, but filmed in Vancouver.
Yeah, with some shots filmed in New York and some establishing shots shot in Seattle. But the rest of it,
yeah. Yeah, I've been to a couple of the filming scenes. That weirdly shaped building that almost looks like an obelisk. So that's just a weird shaped building.
It is. I looked at it and I was like, how is that staying up?
Yeah, it's staying up. It's just you look up at it and it gives you the willies. It's just like that thing's gonna fall.
It does look like a tree that a beaver's been chewing away at.
Yeah,
you know, getting ready to bring it down to use it to dam up some river. But anyway, back to the film.
Well, we were talking about the film.
Yeah, establishing shot, I guess.
Now, there's something that they do not address in the movie that I've always wanted to know the answer to, and I think everyone who watches this movie wants to know the answer to.
What's that?
On the desk of elderly Joseph Carmichael, Senator Carmichael, is a photograph of his father, who looks just like George C. Scott.
Does he?
Yes. Again, bring up the movie and go to the end.
Well, I still have it open, actually. Okay, so
Why does this painting of his father look just like George C. Scott? We don't know.
Similar.
No. That is George C. Scott.
I'm looking.
I believe he was killed in the attic room of that house.
Nah, I mean, yes. Maybe if you put on the same kind of,
I saw what happened.
You know, 1800s mustache that the guy has.
That's obviously George Scott.
I don't know. I think they look similar, but I don't. I wouldn't say that they intentionally just used a painting of.
But
yeah, I really don't think they look anything alike.
What?
I don't see it. Now, I'm looking at a very good shot of the painting, and I don't see it at all.
Ah. Oh. Yeah, you're lying.
I mean, there. Other than the fact that they're both white and middle-aged.
What? You're insane. Wayne.
I think you're looking for similarities. I don't know. I don't see it at all.
You're a madman, I'm telling you.
But anyway,
this was a tale of justice, not vengeance, but justice.
I don't know. I don't know about the justice angle. Because the senator, it wasn't his fault. He was just an orphan. He didn't ask to be.
That's why I'm not saying vengeance. He just wanted the truth to come out. He wanted the truth to be known, and the ghost, that is, wanted the parties involved to know.
I don't blame the ghost killed the senator?
Well, he had a heart attack.
Yeah, I mean, he's scared of death.
He's an elderly senator. What you want to read into that is, you know, whatever. But,
I was a little confused as to why the ghost didn't want George C. Scott's character to go back upstairs, you know, to talk to him. What did he think Scott was going to do? Or Russell?
I don't know.
Well, you know, just it's like,
big,
no.
Just
no.
Big dramatic ending, I guess.
And yeah, that's kind of what I'm getting. And I didn't understand the whole, let's make an illusion of the senator appear in the house, you know.
Illusion or his spirit as he was dying?
Maybe.
Making him, you know, if you want to say the spirit of the senator, climbs the stairs while the house is burning and goes into the attic room where he witnesses the murder happen.
I think the senator was still very much alive when he the senator is staring at the painting of his father or the man who he thought was his father with his medal. He angrily throws away the other medal.
He angrily throws away his own medal and places.
Now, how do you know? How do you know
the chain? The chain, the silver chain, is the original one that they pulled out of the.
Really? Okay.
Out of the well. And so the one he has around his neck is gold.
The wiki one got it wrong. The wiki description of the plot got it wrong then. Yeah, so he got it wrong, so then. He puts the original medallion over the painting, kind of like, you know, that's the its rightful place. You know, that he was acknowledging that it was real, I guess, and discarding the lie. And then he stares at the painting, and the reflection from the metal kind of entrances him, and he starts to see this vision of him walking through the house. It kind of projects him there. I didn't understand that. That was confusing and unnecessary, I think. I think they just should have had him see the scene of the other boy's death without him actually astral projecting into the house. That was,
I don't know, I liked it. I thought it was fine.
That was weird. I, you know what would have been more, I don't know, less confusing would be to have the senator follow George C. Scott to, you know,
his, he actually physically showed up,
yeah, his home, and then it, you know, entranced by the, you know, by the influence of this spirit. And then and have the senator burned to death in the house. That would have been more dramatic, I think, and I less think so.
Yeah,
confusing.
I can agree with you on that. I think the ending as it was fine. But yes, I can see where yours would work as well.
So if it was remade, that's one change I think that they would need to make to make it less confusing. Because that really, I had to watch that part over a couple times. I was like, why? You know, but I love that they built this house and then they just burn it all. Oh, wow. Yeah. And I love that he finally saw the scene here that I'm looking at, you know, where his father is. I wish they would have shown his father's face. I wish they would have gotten an actor and, you know, make him make up, you know, did the makeup and the mustache and everything and then modeled the painting after that actor and then.
Yeah.
Would see, it would tie it all together. Instead, they just never show his father's face.
Bastards. No.
Yeah. That would have been a change I would make. But yeah, man, that explosion. The whole house.
Well, like I said, it's not like it was an actual mansion. It was a facade. It was just the front of the house.
Still. Man, you can build a house for $200,000. What was it? $200,000?
$200,000 to build that facade, yeah.
Wow. I mean, you can have a decent house for $100,000.
Oh, yeah.
So for them to build that and then to build all the material that I guess what you see in the ashes, other than the wheelchair there and the music box at the end, are all the support structures that burnt yeah. behind it. No longer recognizable, of course. Mm-hmm. They did such a good job with that. Okay, where is it? There it is, the house. Yeah, they just kind of show a kind of like a tight shot of a bunch of rubble stacked up right in front of the stairs, but they don't show like a wide shot of the whole foot of the house being.
Well, no,
because there was.
It would probably be a little too obvious. Oh, that's not an entire mansion. House.
Yeah.
And now, I think for the time that it was made, and budgetary constraints, so I think this movie was excellent.
I love the music box at the end, and I love the detail of the music being another link, another connection, you know, that the ghost inspired this composer to compose on his own the same music from the music box. Mm-hmm. You know, that was creepy and spooky. Let me ask you something. Do you think this film inspired some of the details behind The Ring? The original Japanese Ringu?
It's possible.
I mean, it
certainly came out a number of years beforehand and had a couple similar elements. But, of course, Joseph was not alive when he was thrown into the well.
Right, right. But the detail of a child, you know, dead at the bottom of a well underneath, you know, a house. All of those details are very similar. I wonder if that comes from a common... You know, ooh, spooky tales kind of
maybe
thing, but it made me want to watch The Ring again. They're called different kind of scary, but it did make me want to watch that again. There's nothing. This kind of goes back to you know, creepy kids. I don't think there's anything creepier than an angry child ghost.
Yep.
You know.
Yeah, because, when we did our creepy kids podcast, we completely forgot about Joseph Carmichael.
Well, he's hardly ever on screen, but he's still one of the creepiest kids. I mean,
right. Of course, you hadn't seen the movie at that point. So
I really love the Foley work in this film. Everything from the sound of the creaking floorboards. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this was a set, so there were no creaking floorboards. You know, they couldn't really reproduce that just on demand. That's something that just right. happens to a house with age. And the creaping floorboards... just everything, all the ghostly sounds, the voices.
The rhythmic banging of
the rhythmic banging, yes.
The tub, yep.
And I love that detail, too, where there's this banging, and you're like, what is that banging? And you hear it again and again through successive scenes. And then finally it's explained when he sees the murder happen. And you're like, oh. And I love that big reveal moment. Mm-hmm. The kid banging on, the original Joseph, banging on the side of the tub, struggling to...
And keeping... The ghostly presence childlike. He throws a tantrum
mm-hmm.
when John doesn't get things done as fast as he wants. John comes home and the ghost starts slamming doors closed.
Well, the kid's been waiting 70 years, so yeah, I'd be frustrated too.
Yep.
What do you think that the ghost wanted exactly? He wanted acknowledgement from this changeling, this imposter that took his place. That's the meaning of the title, by the way. It isn't the ghost that's, you know, that's what I initially thought, changeling. Ooh, that sounds, you know, I thought that the movie was going to be about a ghost that took on the form of his daughter, you
oh,
know,
to
win him. But really it's the senator. It's this Joseph Carmichael that, I love the detail with the two baptismal medallions, how one is kind of silvery, but the one over the senator, around the senator's neck is gold. So you kind of tell the difference between the two. But the silvery one from the original Joseph, yeah, Russell finds that at the bottom of the well after the bones are recovered. What do you think he told the police? you know, in his statement.
In his statement, I mean, they say when Captain DeWitt comes to confront Russell, he says, you know, John said there was a seance.
Okay, so he told him everything except for the link to the senator.
Right. He said everything except the senator because he didn't want to make any false accusations until there was any kind of proof.
Right.
Wanted to, you know, no accusations until there were proof. So didn't want to mention anything about the senator, which was smart.
You know, if this was remade, I would kind of want there to be less of a time difference between the murder and the discovery, you know, because wouldn't it have been a much better story for the new son to be like in his 30s or in his 40s, you know, with his father still alive, and you know, have this guy who's living in his family's old home start to make all these accusations, and he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's so furious that that these accusations are being made against his father. And meanwhile, his father starts doing really messed up, you know, who's still alive in this version of the story, you know, starts doing really messed up evil things to cover up the murder that he committed. You know, I wish that there had been a present antagonist, you know, other than, a pissed off ghost. You know, I wish there had been somebody. I wish the father would have had his comeuppings, as was what I'm really getting at.
Oh, I see. You know? So you want vengeance.
I want to see the father brought to justice, but he didn't. He lived the rest of his life in apparent luxury and had a son, you know. So I wish that the discovery of the murder and all of that, the haunting and all of that, I wish that took place while the father was still alive.
So you did not have closure.
No. I felt like, you know, the replacement, Joseph Carmichael, was innocent. You know, he was 6 years old.
Right. I mean, I never blamed Senator Carmichael for any of this because he had nothing to do with it. He had no idea.
I just don't feel that sense of justice from this, you know?
Yeah, well, sometimes you can't have a big happy ending.
I think it would just make it a more emotionally satisfying ending to see.
Emotionally satisfying, but I think this is more, I would call this a more realistic.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you don't have the big happy ending. You don't have the big closure. So, I don't know.
I just think it would make a better story, you know?
I think if they redid it today, they probably would put in that aspect. Someone gets punished for this. Just because that's what audiences expect nowadays. Everyone wants quick satisfaction. And, I don't know. I think it works the way it is.
Hmm. Well, it definitely works. There's no arguing that. But if, you know, the classic movie is fine as it is. But I'm just talking about, you know, things I would like to see if they ever remade it.
Right.
That would be an interesting way to readapt. Yeah, I mean,
Harrison Ford, that is.
Yeah, I was going to say, George Harrison.
What is going to. Hello, I'm looking for a ghost. No! Harrison Ford. Sorry, George Harrison. Where the hell? You know what I did? I George C. Scott, George and Harrison
right.
Ford. George
yeah.
Harrison. That's where my mind went, folks. Okay. So what else can we say about The Changeling? It's a very straightforward and serious movie. There's no humor in this movie at all.
None at all.
I mean, during a couple of those very few scenes with the daughter, who is now deceased, being loving, you know, joking dad kind of thing. But outside of that, this was a very serious movie.
Do you think, sorry to go off on a tangent here, do you think at some point while they were developing this, they emphasized... Maybe it ended up on the cutting room floor, but I get the sense that there was supposed to be like a fledgling romance going on between John Russell and I can't remember her.
Claire.
Yeah. Claire Norman, the woman played by Trish Vanderveer.
I think it may have crossed people's mind at some point.
Because, I mean, it's like, oh, you're going riding, are you? Oh, let's go ride horses together, you know, and new friendship. And it obviously has, you know, you can see it in the way she's acting that she's kind of hoping for something there, even though, you know, she's kind of holding off because, okay, this man is in mourning.
But there is a bit of an age difference in that.
That made me curious as to whether that was
I don't know. There's no mention of it in the notes anywhere. I suppose it's possible. I can see where you're coming from on that.
If it was remade, I bet you they would shoehorn in a love interest there with those two.
And then I would step up because I would be one of the producers, and I would step up and go, no.
Now, there's no need for it. It doesn't further the story. It just makes it more complicated.
It makes it more complicated. You're just trying to appeal to the lowest common denominator.
And it's inappropriate because he's mourning.
And then I would grab the director by the throat, and I would go, make the movie the way it's supposed to be made!
And then the director says, okay, so where are we going to put our jump scares?
No jump scare! Actually, there's only one thing in this thing that could have been considered a jump scare.
What's that?
He gets done with Captain DeWitt. He walks down the hallway, looks into a mirror, and the mirror shatters.
Yeah, where he gets the glass in the face.
Okay. Glass in the neck. Okay, so what else could be said about The Changeling?
A surprisingly scary film. I can see why you recommended this for Halloween. And I would definitely say, despite the R rating, this is a family-friendly ghost story.
By today's standard, PG, maybe PG-13.
I would say PG, definitely. If it wasn't for the child murder, that's the only detail, because there's very, very little blood. The bloodiest scene there is a tight shot of the police inspector's face, you know, from inside his upside down car that's been crashed.
When they do show this on TV, it's uncut. They don't edit
there's
anything
nothing,
out.
There's nothing. You know, I can't, there's no cussing, there's no, he says there's no language, there's no blood. Yeah, I mean, there's a tiny little bit of blood, but nothing more than you see on TV today.
The car accident a little bit, and when the mirror breaks, he gets stabbed in the neck with a little shard of glass.
And these are things that you always see after the fact. You never see them happen. You never see anything cut into flesh, or you don't even see the car accident happen.
Right. It is available on DVD from Netflix.
Oh,
all right. Okay. So, The Changeling, George C. Scott, Melvin Douglas, Trish Van Devere. I gave it 4.5 stars out of 5.
I would agree. It's a ghost story told like very few have been. Surprisingly well done for 1980.
Simple and
effective. No special effects whatsoever. Just a freaking good story with great sound design and fantastic acting from Scott and his supporting actors and actresses.
Yeah, and like I said in my review at CinemaUnrest.com, the only thing I really had an issue with was the EVP.
Who's your favorite supporting actress on the thing? Mine was the old busybody.
Minnie.
At the was that her name?
That was the character's name, was Minnie. Let me see. Minnie Huxley. That was Ruth Stepford.
Yeah.
And I got to say, yes, I have to agree with you. For supporting actor, yes. All right. So, Netflix, Amazon, it's available on both. We highly recommend it. I really do think, I mean, if I were to come up with a list of horror movies everyone must see, this is definitely in the category of ghost.
I was surprised. I wasn't expecting to be as entertained by a 1980 film.
I told you!
Yeah.
I told you were going to like this one.
I mean, I like special effects as much as the next guy, but this story did not need them whatsoever. It was just such a good, scary story. And I love the pacing in the film. I love how they just gradually ramp up the tension until you just can't, you're just on the edge of your seat wondering what's going to happen next. Mm. And you know what? And I think the lack of special effects lends to
it makes it more realistic.
Exactly. It makes it, oh my God, this really could be happening. You know, there's nothing there on the screen to tell me this is a movie. I think we've mentioned this before. I think some of the scariest moments are when the actors are in danger. but they don't know it. Because you have that, oh my God, look behind you, look behind you. You know, that feeling is pretty freaking tense. So, yeah.
Honestly, okay, I'm going to say this. I'm not a Hollywood insider. I've never made a movie. I've never been involving in making a movie. But if you're going to make a movie, if you're going to make a ghost movie, watch this one. Because it'll tell you how to do things simply and effectively.
Not that this didn't take a lot of work.
I'm not saying that, you know, any schlub with a video camera can make this, because no, you can't.
The resulting movie is simple, but I guarantee you they spent hours and hours and hours fine-tuning the edit to make sure that this film, you know,
yes,
carried across the screen the way it does.
All right, that's it for The Changeling. Next time on The Monster Club, we'll be looking at the 2003 horror mystery thriller, Darkness Falls.
Well, that's the credits then. Time to stumble our way back out into the sunlight.
Yeah, good one, huh? Popcorn wasn't bad either.
Kind of pricey, though. $6 a taxi by next time, man. What?
Yeah, $6. My $6. I bought the popcorn.
I contributed.
With what? Moral support?
Hey, putting butter flavoring on theater popcorn the right way could still...